Today's Tesho will be on Case 15 in the Book of Serenity. Case 15 is entitled Yang Shan Plants His Hoe. Introduction. Knowing before speech is called silent discourse. Spontaneous revelation without clarification is called hidden activity. Saluting in front of the gate, walking down the hallway, this has a reason. What about dancing in the garden or wagging the head out the back door? Case. Guishan asked Yangshan, "Where are you coming from?" Yangshan said, "From the fields." Guishan said, "How many people are there in the fields?" Yangshan planted his hoe in the ground, clasping his hands, and stood there. Guishan said, "On South Mountain there are a lot of people cutting thatch." Yangshan took up his hoe and went. Verse. The old enlightened one's feelings are many. He thinks of his descendants. Now he repents of setting up a household. We must remember the saying about South Mountain, engraved on the bones, inscribed on the skin, together requiting the blessing. The great master, great Japanese master, Dogen, said that to practice the way of Zen, to practice the way, is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with the 10,000 things. So this is a really wonderful understanding of Zen practice. So, for example, this morning, everyone here came to practice Zen. We sat, some of us from very early and some of us a little later. Together, we entered samadhi to some degree, and then we went outside. And if your mind was still and blank on the cushion, just a little bit, you know, probably going outside to do kinhin was a delicious experience. You know, normally, we are trapped by our self-consciousness. All the time we are concerned about an imaginary person in our heads that we call Kurt or Bob or Susan and so on. And we spend the day thinking about that imaginary person, that fictional character. And sometimes we pay no attention to the world at all. And this is a huge problem. I was reading an article the other day that said that people who suffer from depression and a number of other related disorders, psychological disorders, actually have much higher rates of self-referencing in their thinking processes. I thought that was fascinating. It's certainly not a surprise to somebody who's practiced Buddhism. The researchers had not practiced Buddhism, but they were just studying the conversations of people who suffer from depression or some other related disorders. And they found that their rate of self-referencing was much, much higher than the rate of, say, healthier people. That healthier people could talk about other people or about events in such a way that they lost track of their self-referencing and were taken up by the events or by the objects of their attention. So that would be a healthy person. And the people who are relatively unhealthy are trapped in a kind of prison house of constant self-referencing. I go to a gym. I used to jog early in the morning after I sit, but my knees, after 30 years of jogging, just won't take it. So near my house, there is a gym. And I use an elliptical machine instead of running. And I love the elliptical machine. And often in the morning, a guy comes in who is a really wonderful person. I don't even know his name, but he always says hi. And one of the first things he ever asked me is, what do you think of the Mets? You know, I have to tell you the truth. I'm not really a big sports fan. He said, what do you think of the Mets? And I actually kind of like the Mets. So I said, I like the Mets. He said, what do you think of the Yankees? And I said, I don't know. I don't like the Yankees. You know, they have so much money. They always win. And after that, he was my best friend. So, if you've been, we would get on the elliptical machine. And he, before we really got into it, he would tell me about the Mets games, and with great detail, great analysis. And he would, I have to actually like keep up on the Mets games just to be able to carry on a conversation with him. And I have let him think I'm a bit more of a fan than I am, So I've tried to meet him halfway. So I have to brush up on where the Mets, because I'll go in on a Monday and he'll say, terrible, right? And oh, terrible. And I have to know what I'm talking about, So I have to read how the Mets did over the weekend. He obsesses about the Mets, but he can tell you everything about the game, where they went wrong. And his passion is so wonderful to see. He's in agony because the Mets are screwing up yet again, and yet he's so happy, right? And I think that's a healthy, he might be unhealthy in other ways, but I think that's a healthy engagement with life, So he doesn't worry too much about himself sometimes. He worries about the Mets. He gets furious at the manager, the hitting. He says, the hitting, that's the problem, I don't know, I always just agree. Yes, yeah, you're right, that's so true, But I have been following the Mets because I don't want him to quiz me and I don't want him to realize I'm a phony, which I kind of am. But I'm just trying to enjoy or share with him his passionate engagement with the game of baseball. And his joy, his agonized joy, right, at the fate of the Mets is, I think, just so wonderful to behold. It's like, here is a healthy person, Or at least in this respect, here's a healthy person. Now, if he quit his job and he just sat in the stands, that would be, another kind of disorder. But he has a job, he has a family, he's able to do all these things and still be passionate about the Mets. The article said, that people who are not so mentally healthy create a kind of prison of self-referencing all the time, And I definitely have known people like that, people who are constantly, constantly self-referencing. And indeed, there are some koans that are really about your existential experience, So there are some koans that are asking you to self-reference. So some koans are actually asking you to, sort of explore your subjectivity. But many koans are really not. They're really asking you to report on how the Mets are doing, right? on the cushion. And sometimes you encounter people who are unable to do that because they're so self-referencing. They have suffered some kind of an injury that makes them retreat to this place in the face of uncertainty. And they go back there again and again and again. And, we all have our obstacles, but definitely some people have this. We all have the potential, when we've suffered an injury, when we've suffered some kind of a painful experience, we all tend to contract back into that sort of subjectivity. So when we're in our we're in retreat, when something's hurt us, definitely we close the doors and shut the windows and pull in, But so that's a normal. We all have this tendency. But some people live a lot of their lives like that, and can get very trapped, So, today, when we went outside, it's so wonderful, isn't it, not to be so trapped by our self-referencing. If you were really in samadhi a little bit this morning, when you went outside, there wasn't too much self-referencing, or there was a little less. Maybe you had moments where, you were just looking at the blue sky with a kind of empty mind, or you were just watching the shadows of the trees on the ground with an empty mind. People who can get into samadhi and have those kinds of experiences don't always appreciate how precious it is to get to that place, to be able to see the blue sky, just blue sky. Your consciousness is 100% or 90% blue sky. That is a kind of enlightenment all by itself. It's a kind of liberation all by itself, and it's difficult for some people to get to that place even a couple times a day. So, if you do zazen, that becomes quite routine. Eventually you're able to walk around outside with very few self-conscious thoughts, very few self-referencing processing. Mostly you're just taking it in, and it feels like the inside, it's like you're looking at the world and your head is empty or blank. In Chinese Buddhism, this state of consciousness was often compared to an empty, cloudless sky. Lan tian, blue sky mind. See, the mind becomes like the blue sky, no obstructions, no content. And clouds can drift back and forth across the blue sky, but the sky remains blue and radiant. Sometimes when we do our zazen, we can enter that place. And that is really wonderful. That's really liberation. And, you could think about any form of Buddhist practice as taking you to that place and allowing you to experience the world without falling back into this defensive posture. And when we're in that state, when you see the tree or the shadow, your consciousness is 90% shadow. This is what I mean when I say you become the shadow. There's nothing in your mind at that moment, in that instant, but the shadow of the tree. That's a liberation. And all of Buddhism is producing that experience. Different paths of Buddhism are designed to produce that experience. And if you persist in entering that state repetitively over time, you will have your great awakening experience. Along the way, very liberating. More and more liberation as you walk that path of not self-referencing consciousness. So Dogen is really hits the nail on the head, right? To practice Zen is to study the self, right? I mean, we're sitting on the cushion, watching the mind. So that would be studying the self, watching our consciousness, watching the breath, and watching how we react or respond to the breath, studying the self. Forgetting the self is what happens when we are in deep samadhi, and sometimes the self-referencing stops and the mind becomes quiet or blank. And becoming one with the 10,000 things is when we walk outside and the mind is 100% blue sky, or 90% shadow of tree, or the sound of the wind. I don't know if you noticed the sound of the wind. You can lose yourself in the sound of the wind. You can become one with the sound of the wind. So Dogen is definitely onto something. But there's another way. That is totally true. He's totally correct. But there's another way to approach Zen, and they're really complementary. It's another way to approach Zen. Guishan asked Yangshan, "Where are you coming from?" Yangshan said, "From the fields." Guishan said, "How many people are there in the fields?" Yangshan planted his hoe in the ground, clasped his hands, and stood there. Guishan said, "On South Mountain, there are a lot of people cutting thatch." Yangshan took his hoe and went. You know, in ancient times in China, people did work. People worked. So, you know, monks and nuns got up in the morning and they did sutra recitation, just as we do on a Saturday. And then they did meditation and they had their breakfast. And if it wasn't sesshin, if it wasn't time for chan chi, for a seven-day sesshin, they would go out and they would have to work some portion of the day. You know, in Indian Buddhism, monks and nuns don't work. They are supposed to be taken care of by the generosity of the community. So if you're a monk or you're a nun in a Theravada country, if somebody doesn't take care of you, you technically could starve to death, because you are supposed to be totally dependent on your lay supporters, and your lay supporters know that they have to take care of the monk or the nun. So it's like a child and a parent, right? The relationship between the lay people and the sangha in a Theravada country is like child and parent. If you don't take care of the sangha of monks and nuns, they will disappear. So people have an obligation to, like, prepare food every day. Somebody in the community has to take care of that. And in some communities, monks and nuns go begging for food. Now, in China, this didn't work because not everybody supported Buddhism. Indeed, some people really opposed Buddhism. So, you know, Buddhist monks, especially in the Chan school, decided to take care of themselves. There was actually a reformulation of monastic tradition or monastic rules, and there was a saying: if you don't work, you don't eat. You know, so that was the Zen approach. So Zen monks and nuns had to go out and weed the fields. Pull, you know, weeds so their vegetables could flourish, or plant rice, and they would be outside all day doing hard labor to make it possible to continue to practice the Buddha's way. And then they would come in the afternoon and wash off and sit down and do their zazen late into the night. So this is a story that takes place in that milieu, in that world. And basically, Huishan asks Yangshan, "Where are you coming from?" Yangshan says, "From the fields." Huishan said, "How many people are there in the fields?" Yangshan planted his hoe on the ground, clasped his hands, and stood there. So you might say, what is this about? There's a little bit of a clue in the introduction. Knowing before speech is called silent discourse. Spontaneous revelation without clarification is called hidden activity. Saluting in front of the gate, walking down the hallway, there, this has a reason. Okay. So, thinking, it can be imprisoning even when we're not obsessing about ourselves. So it's definitely the case that self-referencing thought can create a kind of prison. But it's also the case that other kinds of thinking can also create a kind of prison for us, even when we're not self-referencing. So, I once was doing a koan that's not in a koan collection, any koan collection I know. My teacher at the time asked me to tell him to communicate the voice of the raindrops. He said, bring me the voice of the raindrops. And there was a lot of rain. I sat with this koan listening to the rain for a couple days. Then I went in to see him in Dokusan. And I said, every raindrop is the whole world. And, if you're really listening to the raindrops, each raindrop, it becomes the whole world. It becomes the whole world. Your consciousness is 100% raindrop if you're in deep samadhi. And each raindrop is 100% everything. So when you're in samadhi and you focus on the sound of a rain, every patter of rain seems to be the whole world. This is actually an enlightened mind. This is how awakened mind perceives the world. Great and small are all the same. The universe is in a drop of rain, and the drop of rain is the universe. So this is actually quite advanced. Anybody who practices meditation for a long time will be able to have this experience. So I went in to the teacher and I said, every drop of rain is the whole universe. And he said, oh, that's okay as an answer. And I thought, what have I missed? And I said, what do you mean, okay? And he said, well, there's a better answer. And remember, I had been listening to this rainstorm for several days. And he jumped up and he ran around the zendo going like that, like the sound of rain. And, I have to tell you, I instantly knew that was a better answer. I actually thought of doing that. At one point, listening to the sound of the rain, I actually thought I ought to get up and just go and see how it feels. But I was too inhibited. We can become prisoners of ideas, of conventional ideas, and we're not able to let out what's really inside us. you know. So I wanted to, you know, if I had been 5 years old and somebody had asked me this question, I might have actually jumped up and gone, you know. But at that time, I was 42 or something. And I had been well socialized into containing myself, you know, and allowing myself only to feel and think like acceptable things, right? So you know, you could say that there was a part of me that was really telling me to get up and run around the room, but there was another part of me saying, "Don't do that. You'll be a fool, right? You're a fool. You make a fool of yourself." And I have made a fool of myself on occasion, and I didn't enjoy the experience, you know. So I didn't do it on this occasion. And damn it all, if the Roshi didn't do it, you know. So you know, sometimes we need to trust ourselves more than we do, you know. That, you know, sometimes the feeling comes before the thought, or the impulse comes before the understanding. You know, this is often the case. You know, so in like a therapeutic situation, people will be that it's like you're feeling something, or your impulse is pushing you to do something, and you're keeping the lid on it, right? Just with all your might. And you might go to a therapist, and the therapist says, "How are you today?" And you say, "Oh, very well, thank you. Everything's wonderful. I'm just a little tired. I'm sleeping a lot lately. Maybe I'm working too hard." You know, but what you're tired because you're keeping the lid on something, and it takes so much energy, you're exhausted. You know, that's quite common. So, like in a therapeutic situation, a therapist is going to try to get the person to loosen up on the lid and let whatever is in there come out. But the person is scared to let whatever is in there come out because it doesn't fit, you know, with the image that person wants to create of himself or herself, you know. A classic example, another example of this is like from in Buddhist communities. You know, the Buddha specifically said no violence. He specifically said hate is a bad thing. In one of the earliest Buddhist teachings, the Buddha says, not by hate, are things set right, but by love. So, you know, early Buddhist teaching, probably the Buddha's own words are, not hate, love. Not violence, non-violence. You know, it is said that in the history of the early Sangha, not everybody in India liked Buddhism either. And some monks were walking down the street and somebody hit a monk. And the monks hit him back and the Buddha said, "I'm sorry, but you are no longer a monk. You have broken the monastic rules." So, it's not correct to hit somebody if they hit you back from the Buddhist standpoint. You know, so sometimes people who are Buddhists, who are committed to Buddhist practice, experience things that produce anger. And, you know, they tamp it down. They tamp it down because they think, "I'm a Buddhist, I should not give way to anger." You know, and one of the things I have tried to emphasize over the years, not always successfully, is that it's okay to be angry. You can be an angry Buddhist, you know, you can. You can't shoot somebody and be a Buddhist. But if you're feeling anger, you have to trust yourself enough to acknowledge its existence. And yet then you can begin to understand the sources of your anger. But if you won't trust yourself enough to let it out, you can't achieve any wisdom about it, right? So in a way, you know, you have to let anger come out. You have to acknowledge the presence of anger. I think I've mentioned this before, you know, in Japanese temples, the door, the gateway to the temple is guarded by angry figures. So you it's like you have to admit, you know, this is there. This is there. Now you can go into the temple. It's like you have to pass by these figures in Chinese and Japanese temples in order to get to the wisdom inside. The problem is that we don't trust this deeper mind. In Zen we talk about your true nature, or Buddha mind. And a Buddha mind operates unconsciously. There's an unconscious mind which is more intelligent than your conscious mind. See? And it's way ahead of your conscious mind. It grasps things much faster than your conscious mind. So, you know, this is quite commonly the case. So, I don't know if you've ever had this happen, but, you know, sometimes I have to go to these meetings as in my job, like committee meetings, and I'll walk into a committee meeting and I'll have this very strong impression that there's tension in the room, you know. And then little by little I'll realize, oh, there's a lot of hostility in this, you know, people really don't like each other in this room, you know, and I'm not a particularly intuitive person. But, you know, we all pick up on these cues, right? And you just, you come in and you can, after 3 minutes, your unconscious mind is processing all this. You begin to feel uneasy for some reason, you know? And then you realize, oh, people are at loggerheads with, they're at each other's throats, you know? It's like, how did I know that before I had evidence to reach a rational conclusion about it? Well, I think your unconscious mind is pulling in all this information and processing it much faster. So, you know, Dogen is right. You know, cultivating, forgetting the self and cultivating, you know, blank mind and then going out and experiencing the world is the path of Zen. But there's also this other path of Zen, which is, more closely associated with like koan training. You know, we have to learn to trust what we call our big mind, our Buddha mind. And the Buddha mind is always running ahead of the conscious mind. So if you don't trust the Buddha mind, if you don't trust the big mind, you're going to be like me. You're not going to give a good answer to your koan, but you're also not going to live life as skillfully and fully aware as you can otherwise, you know. So a lot of Zen training in our school involves learning to trust, you know, we talk about trust. Well, what do we trust? Well, we have to trust this big mind. We have to be willing to open to whatever is coming out. And, you know, people are typically terrified that inside themselves there is a monster or a murderer, right? I mean, and indeed, you know, we have prisons full of people who have done terrible things. And, you know, all the time you were growing up, parents were telling you you were doing bad things, right? So, you know, if you're a kid and there's two cookies on a plate and they're not your cookies, you will probably steal one. You know, you probably will. And your parents will say, no, that was not your cookie. You know, and they might even say, that was bad. And you could interpret that as, I am bad. A little kid would even say, I've been bad. You know, I did a bad thing. I was bad. So we grow up believing that we're bad, you know, and we tend to look to other people for guidance, which is not necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, you look to other people for guidance, but it becomes a bad thing if you don't develop trust in your big mind. You know, so a lot of our training in Zen is developing trust in your big mind. You know, koans, you know, a teacher gives you a koan. If you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. See, and your teacher gives you that, and you go back to your cushion and think, what the hell? If you have a staff, I will give you one. We already have a staff. If you have no staff, I'll take it away. How can you take it away? So, see, there's no way your intellectual mind, your self-referencing, discriminating mind, is going to be able to answer this question. And then you might say to yourself, oh, you know, crap, this is impossible. I'll never answer this koan. I'll never do this. And then, you know, you sit with the koan, and, you know, a lot of sitting with the koan is waiting for the little mind, the thinking mind, to shut down, get into samadhi. And then, you know, a lot of it is just waiting to it's just developing the trust, either by just giving up or actually developing positive trust enough to hear what your inner self, your Buddha mind, is saying to you, right? And so a lot of working with a koan is learning how to trust what is coming out. What is coming out? You know, we all have ideas of what enlightenment is supposed to be like, and they tend to get in the way of our actual waking up. You know, in a very famous koan, Joshu puts his shoes on his head. That's the answer to the koan. Now, that's admirable in Zen, not because it's a crazy action, but because that must have been what his true nature told him to do spontaneously. So a lot of Zen practice is learning how to trust, we say, your big mind. And often the little mind and the big mind are at odds. Sometimes the big mind is ordering you to do something that you don't want to do, like run around the Dokusan room sounding like rain. But if you do it, you will be happier, and you will feel more complete, you know. But sometimes, you know, there is this conflict between, we say, little mind and big mind. You know, because, you know, we do want to be socially acceptable. Maybe somebody told us we shouldn't be feeling this way or having this response. And that is why people can't usually answer their koans right away. There's some kind of inner conflict or some kind of psychological conflict between the answer they're getting and the answer they think they should be giving. Just if you've come to a sesshin, you know what this is like. I mean, look, when you come to a sesshin, around day two, most people say, you know, the small mind of most people say, this is impossible. This is impossible. But, you know, if you don't get in your car and drive away, if you stay, the next day, there's usually a great gain in your energy, your mental focus, and just even joy. You know, some people come in on day three or day four of sesshin and say, I just feel like I'm in heaven. You know, when, in Zen we call this the matching halves. When the conscious mind and the unconscious mind operate in harmony, you know, this energy and joy arises. You know, energy and joy arise. And usually people are at war with themselves and exhausted by keeping the lid on. You know. So in this case, Guishan asked Yangshan, where are you coming from? Now, you know, in our tradition, we have Dokusan and I give you a koan, and you go and sit with the koan, and at the end of the evening, or at Dokusan time, you come in and you present your answer. It's very formalized and workable. But in the old days in Zen, before this system fully developed, you know, your teacher might pose a question, a teacher might pose a question to the student spontaneously, just out in the fields. So there's a story about a teacher and a monk, and they're outside, and a wild duck flies by. And the teacher says, "That what was that?" And the student says, "A wild duck." And the teacher says, "Is it gone?" And the student says, "Yes." And the teacher grabs his nose and twists it. What's that all about? See, that's a direct exchange between student and teacher. The teacher wants to know, are the two sides of yourself operating in harmony or not? Are you at war with yourself or are you awake? See? So this is the same thing here. Guishan asks Yangshan, where are you coming from? And Yangshan said, from the fields. Now, hopefully we'll have a chance to do this koan together. Is that a good answer or not? From the fields. Guishan said, how many people are there in the fields? See, in a way he's saying, well, is anybody else out there? You know, are you out here by yourself? Are you where you're supposed to be? And Yangshan takes his hoe and he puts it in the ground and stands there. See, now, that is actually a wonderful answer, right? I mean, he trusts his true nature. He trusts his big mind. I am coming from I am doing what my big mind is telling me to do. Now, how do you get to your big mind? You have to spend a lot of time in samadhi. You have to be in that empty state. And then there are, you know, subconscious stirrings, you know, unconscious stirrings. You know, one way to think about this is your the deepest core of your mind is enlightened. You are already enlightened. So how come you don't feel enlightened? Well, we've closed all of these, we've wrapped enlightenment in all of these layers of anxiety and fear and expectation. And so the Zen student is trying to take layer after layer off enlightened mind. But enlightened mind is very actively moving in the other direction. I swear to you that when you have your great awakening experience, and if you persist, if you trust yourself, you will. When you have the great awakening experience, you will understand, you will just know without any shadow of a doubt that your big mind has been operating to bring you to this place all your life. That the big mind has been busily, you've been asleep, but big mind has been working to help you wake up. Even when you were sleeping, it wasn't sleeping. That requires a lot of trust, but that's Zen teaching. Your big mind is helping you day and night to wake up. It's trying to help you peel away all those layers. As you answer koans, you know, you begin to develop a deeper and deeper trust in that big mind intelligence. You know, and at first, it's very difficult to trust the big mind. Eventually, you know, it's second nature. It's natural. You know, it's natural. So you know, everybody here today did something so important. You came and you sat down on the cushion, you watched your breath, and you worked with your koan, and you had moments of samadhi. And this is so important. This is the path to enlightenment, just this simple act. And, you know, it shows more trust than you probably realize. You know, for a long time, I was just doing Zen. At first, I think I did Zen because I was kind of depressed. And it made me feel better. But then I was just sort of slogging along blindly. And at times I would have these moments where I would think, what am I doing? I'm getting up at 4:30 in the morning. I'm going to sit at the Zen Center. You know, I'm not going to the movies with my friends. You know, I'm not getting my I could do my dissertation a year sooner, you know, blah, blah, blah. What am I doing? But, you know, eventually you realize all of this was this wonderful drama unfolding, this wonderful unfolding drama that led to my awakening. Day and night, your enlightened mind is trying to help you wake up. Please work with your enlightened mind. And the beautiful thing is all you have to do is sit down on the cushion and enter samadhi and work on your koan. And the big mind will do the rest. So Yangshan knows this. You know, he spends a lot of time in samadhi. He trusts his big mind. So Guishan says, where are you coming from? Yangshan says, from the fields. Guishan says, well, is that where you're supposed to be? Is there anybody else out there? And Yangshan plants his hoe and clasps his hands and stood there. I'm where I'm supposed to be. And probably entered deep samadhi. Guishan said, on Stone Mountain, there are a lot of people cutting thatch. Yangshan took up his hoe and went. See, so, I mean, basically, Guishan pays Yangshan a compliment. He says, you know, over on South Mountain, all of these people are running around like chickens with their heads cut off because they don't know how to trust their big mind. They don't know how, they don't have that trust. Good, he says, in a way saying, good work. You have that trust. Sitting on the cushion, entering samadhi, waiting for the voice of the universe to speak to you. That takes trust. That's the way. See? And he says, you know, you're the only one out in this field. In the other field, there's 100 monks, and none of them have a clue. Right? They're all running hither and yon because they can't trust their true nature. So, everybody here today trusted their true nature. You know, maybe your small mind said, I'm too tired, blah, blah, blah. You know, something in you said, get up and go and sit. And you did it. So, thank you for taking such good care of your true self. Please continue. Guishan said to Yangshan, where are you coming from? Yangshan said, from the fields. Guishan said, how many people are there in the fields? Yangshan planted his hoe, clasped his hands, and entered samadhi. Guishan said, on South Mountain, there are a lot of people cutting thatch. Thatch is a symbol of distraction, confusion. Yangshan took up his hoe and went. Verse, the old enlightened one's feelings are many, and he thinks of his descendants. Now he repents of setting up a household. We must remember the saying about South Mountain, engraved on the bones, inscribed on the skin, together requiting the blessing. So remember that in Zen, when somebody wants to pay somebody else a compliment, sometimes they seem to be criticizing them. So he says, the old enlightened one's feelings are many. He thinks of his descendants. Now he repents of setting up a household. So he's basically saying, you know, Yangshan and Guishan created this lineage in Zen, and they regret it because it's, he means it's a wonderful thing, basically. And he said, we must remember South Mountain. In other words, remember, you know, don't try to please others. Listen to your true nature. Don't try to be respectable. right? Don't try to be normal. Enter deep samadhi and listen to that voice. That's the path to awakening.